congregation of Sakwa. We will introduce ourselves formally now. I also would want to request people just to keep the cell phones off. Otherwise, you're going to have that blur every time, even if you don't find it. I've been informed by my committee secretary that, and they'll explain that there was a little bit of a confusion of 9:30 or 10 o'clock. So we want to apologize. It seems to me that the committee, away from our committee, but the management section that deals with the documentation, didn't appropriately correct it in the parliamentary document. But with that, let me, in fact, just indicate that I'm Maurice Fransman, responsible for our education and training. Anele.
My name is Anele, the committee secretary of the committee.
My name is Dennis Bandy. I'm a content advisor.
This is Nkadebe, a member of parliament in the ANC organization. He's also from Mpumalanga. My name is Wilma James, and I'm a member of the committee.
Hi, my name is Nolita Vukuza. I'm a member of the committee.
I'm Silent Makwela, a member of the committee.
Mrs. Kumakazi, a member of the committee.
Josh Binamo, the member of the committee. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Grant Snow. I'm a member of the committee.
Morning. I'm Zoraina. I'm the secretary to the chairperson. Sharon Dudley, member of the ACDP. Thank you.
I'm Shirley Walters, I'm the chair of SACWA.
I'm the chief executive officer of SACWA.
I'm Joe Samuels, I'm the deputy executive officer.
Let me then formally welcome all of you again. Member Stout, you are new in this committee, am I right?
Yes.
This is the first meeting? Okay. Is this the only one or any other one? Okay, and which one are you prioritizing? Because we've got a very strong perspective here that we write to the various groups in Parliament and say that please, we are only requiring people that are prioritizing this one. So, but out of the, I think I've met you in a committee meeting or a meeting between Labour and ourselves, but it was a study group, and I thought your input there around higher education was quite valuable. So clearly you've got a passion and a support for engagement here. So I think we value that. I received an apology from Honourable Member Nsetso. I think he's on leave for the next few days. Is it paternity leave? He's richer with a baby. So I've SMS'd him last night and said to him, he didn't know he's got so much time on his hands. any other apology?
Can I
just get clarity? Secretly, what actually, why was the... a 9:30 or 10 o'clock conclusion. If you can just clear that so that we know where the origin, where it comes from, so that we can correct those things for the future.
The problem, the Z list, which is also known as the ETC, actually the meeting was not updated. So they had a committee room 1, 10 o'clock, but apparently they couldn't change it. So in my SMS, I indicated that the meeting is at 2:00 to 6:00. That was the problem.
Okay. So Anele did often recognize that. I think we sent out an SMS to everyone. So what we'll consistently do is now that we know there must be an official somewhere in this parliament that possibly didn't update it, so we're going to ask Anele just to indicate that to the official so that we can ensure corrective measures every time and ensure quality processing. But with that, this meeting members will be twofold. The one will be dealing with the SACWA, and then the other one our internal business after SACWA. Sorters, let me therefore welcome you. And we've now received briefings from NSFAS, from Higher Education South Africa, one or two programs. We in fact visited NSFAS offices. We believe as a committee that that there is much to be done in the question of quality of education. The committee is also now responsible soon from the 1st of November dealing specifically with NSF National Schools Fund, the various CETAs, and that transitional arrangement in all of that. I think we've got a view that says, yes, we must do all of these things, but whilst we're doing that, there's the importance of delivery, like yesterday. And you are the quality assurers of South Africa, and hopefully you can give us the brief, but also give us an indication of your own critical issues. Is the sense holding in a sense? Is the strength of quality assurers, is it the capacity issues, the constraints, also where you are moving into the future? We were very specific in terms of the request for briefing, but you'll be able to do some introductory remarks in the overall stuff. So over to yourself.
Thanks very much, and good morning, everybody. As I understand it, there were two very specific questions that you were asking us to address. One related to progress and challenges in relation to the recognition of prior learning, and the other was plans in regard to unregistered colleges and use of irregular qualifications. But recognizing that the systems are quite complicated, what we've decided to do is just to contextualize those questions, and so that we're all speaking off the same page, so to speak, with the same background. So, and particularly with the new NQF Act, which was promulgated and from the beginning of June, it's all a new terrain. With your permission, what we'll do is just give one or two slides which give you that overall context. Firstly, to say I've been the chairperson of SACWA now for 5 years. I'm a professor of adult education from the University of the Western Cape and have been there for nearly 25 years. So I'm very familiar with the world of adult education and education generally, both higher education and in the workplace. And what I must say up front is that this is in fact a good news story. In South Africa, we seldom really appreciate good news stories. And I'd like to just say that at the start. The South Africa's national qualification framework is one of the best kept secrets in the country. But as is often the case internationally, it's gaining a lot of recognition. I suppose that's the usual case. We're appreciated away from home before we were appreciated at home. And this came home to me very clearly when the CEO and myself were in Brussels in February this year at the European Qualification Framework Conference, where there were at least, don't quote me specifically, but I think there were at least 100 countries that are looking to or have developed national qualification frameworks, and it's growing like a virus around the world, and we can talk a bit about that. But South Africa's national qualifications framework is one of the early ones. And, in fact, the CEO, Samuel Isaacs, is the longest the longest serving CEO of a national qualifications framework anywhere in the world, and he's known as our monument. So you must please pay him lots of respect. So I think what we need to do is to recognize that the national qualifications framework that was developed and thought about from the late 80s and then eventually implemented in 1995 and so on has got a long history, and a lot of work has been done and is now seen as a leader in the world. What I wanted to do is just to give you some background, and this is a very complex slide, and I apologize for it, but hopefully it's really just a snapshot, a quick snapshot of what's been going on. A national qualifications framework is an essential mechanism to help a system, education training system, communicate, collaborate, and coordinate itself, and this in relation to work. So here we have a mechanism which is trying to bring things together, and the way that we've done it, and the way that the general trend in the world is to develop national qualifications frameworks to use qualifications as ways of trying to get this collaborative approach to systems. For the first 10 years, and you'll see on the slide the little green circles, what we've called the bedrock infrastructure. We have been developing this bedrock infrastructure, which relates to the development of quality qualifications, and this in order to develop quality qualifications, you've got to have quite involved systems of standard setting and quality assurance. We've got that's the little green ball on the left, so it's quality qualifications. The second little ball on the coming from the left is the verification of foreign qualifications. And so anyone coming into the country which has a foreign qualification, they come through SACWA. And another basic part of the bedrock is the development of the National Learner's Record Database. So those are essential parts of trying to verify the validity of the system and to capture data. On the very far right, you've got the little green ball, which is about advocacy, communication, and coordination and partnerships. You can't create a national qualifications framework without advocating, communicating, and working in partnership across all the systems. I think that SACWA is about the only a state institution that works across the total system, from professional bodies to schools to the workplace and so on. So it's the one body that has oversight across the entire system, and I think it's very important. The other part of the bedrock infrastructure that we've been building, which is represented there with RWL, which means researching, work, and learning. You have to be researching your systems all the time, and we're strengthening our research partnerships with various providers, with institutions, with workplaces. And, of course, all of this is done within the framework of the HRD strategy and the National Skills Development Strategy. So what you have is a national qualifications framework that is used as the glue, or to use another metaphor, to the instrument that tries to energize the relationships across learning, teaching, and development. So I think that is the broad bedrock that has been built. About 2 years ago, we realized that we've necessarily spent a great deal of time building these systems, and they're complex. And people find them very hard to work out and find their way through. But the whole time, and part of the NQF goals and values is about helping the learners. Helping the learners have easy access. Helping the learners have greater mobility, portability of qualifications, and so on. And we stopped and said to ourselves, but what is the system which is helping those learners? So we've been building the institutional structures, the policies, and all the rest of it. But if you stopped anyone in the street, or you go to a further education or higher education institution and say, tell me about the NQF, they'd go, duh. They wouldn't know a lot. And we then said, well, we really need to look at what is happening in the area of career advice services, because the individuals access the system through the quality of advising and counseling. So we began an environmental scan and to try to assess what in fact is happening, and then to ask ourselves what is FACTA's role in all of this. We found a very mixed picture, and some of you might know that I started a careers research and information center, which was the first community-based center in the late 70s, so I'm quite old. But what shocked me in a way was to realize that, and I did the first study to ask the question about what guidance and counseling is available to black learners in this country. And I must say, the picture is not that different. And that is a scary thought. There are pockets of, if you use a weather analogy, there are pockets of excellent practice. But there are large parts of the country that are like a desert. So you can sort of see a kind of thundercloud metaphor. So you've got some people doing excellent work, but if you're middle class, as with so many parts of our society, if you're middle class, you can access things, if you can pay for them. But in terms of the actual facilities available to the majority of people, they are sorely lacking. So what we found is that there's a real need for a national initiative around the development of a career advice service, and we've been exploring, and in fact the chairperson and some of the SACWA staff and others have visited the UK recently, and really the idea of establishing a helpline which can be available through cell phone technology and so on to everyone in the country is something that we could and should look at very seriously, and so they're very, very concerted efforts at a national level to try to see what one can do to get the systems across further education, higher education, workplaces, and so on and so forth, coming together through the provision of a national helpline. So that's the one area where we've done the groundwork. In your pack, in fact, is the initial report on career guidance, challenges, and opportunities. So when you have nothing else to do, you can peruse that and see the kinds of arguments that have been made and the picture that's painted. The second area, which in fact was thought about from the late 80s, was really the recognition of prior learning. And the recognition of prior learning, its intention is to be an instrument to build a more inclusive system, to provide ease of access to different levels and forms of learning to those who have been left out. It's very much an instrument for redress and equity. Now, in the last 10 years, They have again. I think the weather analogy would work for RPL as well. And there are areas where there's excellent practice, and there are desert-like conditions in many parts of the country. So we're now a lot smarter. We understand a lot more about the recognition of prior learning. It's a complex system. It's not something that you can just walk in and do. It's about, because it is about giving people access who might not normally get, in terms of the system, might not normally be given access, and it's about encouraging articulation. And I want to give you just one example from my own university, the University of the Western Cape, who has taken the recognition of prior learning very seriously and is seen as one of the leaders in the country. And what we've done included in your packs is something that came out just a couple of weeks ago, which is a learning journal. And in there you'll see some of the stories of some of the learners who have come through the system. And very interestingly, some of our research is showing, and it's something that we've been aware of, but now we increasingly have the data, is that the students coming through the recognition of prior learning are some of your high achievers. So whether they come in with a grade 9 or grade 8 or grade 10 into higher education, they're in fact some of your highest achievers. And my colleague was telling me last night that in terms of the latest data, students in their first year, most students, as you'll know also from your discussions with NIFAS, most students stop out, and I'm using the word stop out deliberately rather than drop out, of higher education because of economic circumstances. They can't afford to be there. So most of them want to come back, and that's why stopping out is a more appropriate word than dropping out. And if we take the students who've come through recognition of prior learning, we have 23% at our university at the moment who stop out after 1 year. The regular students is 50%. Part of the reason we think, part of the explanation for this, is a very good and careful guidance program. So if you're coming in and you're wanting to come in through recognition of prior learning, you're taken through a 3-month process of portfolio development. So you actually are guided to the more correct place you should be. So we don't just accept them. We in fact are guiding them through the process of portfolio development. And I think that's where the linkage between RPL and career advice services is absolutely critical. You have to have good guidance programs, good guidance services to help your students know where exactly they're going at a given time. So we're at the point now with the new NQF Act, and we'll talk more about exactly what that means. But in the development of the navigational tools, both in terms of the career advice services and the recognition of prior learning, we're a lot smarter. We know what's out there. We know what good practice means. And now we need the national will. We also need support from the systems to recognize the essential catalytic function that both of these processes require. And for example, NISFAS barely supports part-time learners. The assumption is that people who come through part-time, somehow they're working and they don't need help. Now, we've campaigned from the University of Western Cape side for many, many years trying to get them to realize that this is actually not true. And we have to have systems that recognize the notion of stopping out. And that even if someone's working, they might be working at the pick and pay cashier outlet, and they've got children to support and so on. So one has to look at this much more seriously. Recognition of prior learning is an unfunded mandate. Our university has to choose to put money behind RPL. It's not funded. There is no funding basket from which we can draw. And so you here you have a national policy, but in fact you do not have the system which is saying, right, we're right behind you, we think this is a really good thing, and we really are concerned with redress and equity. So I think this is the national context.
Clarity. Are you saying in the education envelope there is no money put aside for RPL?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So it's a really very, very important thing. The other aspect in terms of RPL that we've learned is that the people giving guidance and counselling and supporting RPL candidates, they need to be qualified. They need to be carefully nurtured and supported. And again, it's not something which is identified as a career path, for instance. Because in fact, there is the funding for it is so tentative. So with that as the broad background, I'd like to hand across to the CEO, Samuel Isaacs, to address the more specific questions. Thank you.
What I will be doing is the role of SACWA and the qualification councils. With the implementation of the MPF Act from the 1st of June this year, there was the establishment of three quality councils, two of which already exist, Umalusi and the Council on Higher Education. And the third one is a quality council for trades and occupations. I'll come back to that particular qualification council a number of times, because I think that's an area that we have to strategically navigate, because that could be an area that might cause us delays in the system. What I try to do is to look at SACWA and the quality council, to look at their functions and try and group them together so that you can see who's doing what. So SACWA continues to oversee the implementation and further development of the NQF and to advance the objectives of the NQF. I'm sure if I ask the portfolio committee, they'd be able to tell us exactly what those objectives are. Mm. It's about access, quality, redress, and development, and all of this in a integrated national framework. And then the quality councils have to develop and manage a sub-framework. Now, here is a challenge, and in a number of ways. Umalusi will look after the schools, and before we had the Ministry of Higher Education and Training and the Ministry of Basic Education and Training, they were looking after the FET colleges. So the question that would immediately stir is, who is going to look after the FET colleges? Is it going to remain the mandate of Umalusi, or is it going to be a shared mandate? The Council on Higher Education is quite clear, but the Council for the Qualification the Council for trades and occupations, in fact, is also going to look after levels 1 to 10. And so if you're looking across the levels of the NQF, then is there going to be a dual mandate between the Council for Trades and Occupation and the Council for Higher Education? So I pose that as a potential challenge. The important thing that both SACWA and the QCs have to do is to develop and participate in a system of collaboration. And at the moment, that is happening quite excellently between SACWA and CHE, mutually in both directions, and with SACWA and Umalusi, and with Umalusi and the CHE. But because the QCTO is not in place yet, there is a missing partner at the table. And so that's quite a critical issue that needs to be resolved. In terms of level descriptors, SACWA has already gazetted level 1 to 4. Level 5 to 10 was on the previous minister's desk,
And all that we need to do is to make sure that we reach agreement with the three QCs. The one QC is not there, so you can't reach agreement with a body that's not there. And so it's there ready to move once the QCTO is in place. We may have to find some creative way to deal with that. Maybe we have to agree that we use those level descriptors and that we can revise them once the QCTO is up and running. In terms of qualifications, I think it's important for the Portfolio Committee to understand that SACWA had both standard setting and quality assurance executive functions. We do not have those executive functions anymore. We register the qualifications, and so there's an executive function, but we do it in terms of a mutually agreed policy and criteria for qualifications and assessments. And the Quality Council have the executive authority for standard setting and quality assurance. Now, the question immediately, again, if there's no QCTO, who is going to do the standard setting and the quality assurance of the existing qualifications that is in the system? And I've already raised an objection with the Department of Labor. The QCTO, in the body that is trying to put that in place, they made the unilateral decision to not look after the qualifications that have already been registered. And I said, I think that's illegal. So, again, it's pointing to a particular issue that needs to be resolved. With regard to the CHE and Umalusi, there are clear arrangements in place for the transition. So we don't envisage any major problems in that area. In terms of quality assurance, I've already said that we have no executive function. We have to coordinate across the sub-framework, and we also have a specific responsibility for a periodic impact study of the NTF as a whole. And we've already commissioned the Joint Education Trust to do a preliminary sketching of the terrain that we have to cover in the impact study, and we'll make that available when that work is done. The quality councils, they must ensure the quality assurance in each of the sub-frameworks, and obviously we have a mutual a job to ensure integrity and credibility and to collaborate on the impact study. In terms of research, SACWA does the impact study in collaboration with the QCs, and we want to maintain and further develop a collaborative research agenda relevant to the development and implementation of the NQF. My colleague, Joe Samuels, when he talks about the RPL, for example, in more detail, you'll see there is a collaborative research project with UWC and a number of other partners. The research into work and learning was a collaborative venture with UWC, UCT, and the Human Sciences Research Council. So again, because our mandate is the National Qualification Framework, we're looking to work in a synergetic fashion with other bodies, not to do unnecessary duplication. And the Quality Council focus on sub-framework-specific research. And again, we try to, in the system of collaboration, conduct and commission research mutually, publish the findings, and a lot of collaboration in terms of that. And while it's easy to say collaborate, and form partnerships, anybody who has tried to do that will know that to build relationships takes time, and you have to suck so top yet with people before you can move. In terms of information management, I think I don't have to tell parliamentarians this. Whenever you want to do something and you want data, then the problem starts. And we've given this country a very good national learner record database, and there are at least three other countries that have asked us to help them build their databases, for which they'll pay for. And each quality council, in terms of the NQF Act, has to keep a database of their sub-framework, and they have to submit the data to the National Learner Record Database. Now, here I want to digress for a minute, because the problem with data, for example, if you take higher education, which is probably the most developed part of our system, the Department of Education has a higher education management information system. But the information that SACL gets is at least 3 years behind. The reason it's 3 years behind is because the Department now of Higher Education and Training has to audit that data very carefully, because subsidies get paid against that particular data. And so they must make sure that the headcounts and effective students and all of those, that information is fine. But it doesn't help policymakers if you want to know how many people are in the system and how many more people you can support in the system. At the same time, the database for private providers is also underdeveloped. In higher education, again, SACL is working with the CHE to put that database in place. Now, I think that what we need to do is to accelerate that kind of information and make sure that the information is current. You can't live in a digital age where your data is 3 and 4 and 5 years out of date. So I think that's a particular point I want to make. Just on that,
can you say, because one of some you pride yourself in this NLRD. Are you saying that the NLRD, as if you go now to it, so if you can just give a quick reflection, what is the what would be in the system in that database system, one, and two, are you saying it's quite, it's 3 years outdated in it?
Because the database is dependent on primary information. So, for example, people graduated at the end of last year, and they graduated in March and in April and in May in many institutions. That data will not be on the database. And so what we have to then do is to go to the institution to check that out. Now, if we streamlined and got that information quicker onto the system, and we believe we can do it, then it, in fact, is going to be a lot better. So what happens is there's always a gap that we are aware of. We know what the gap is, but we are saying it's now the time to make sure that that gap is down to a minimum time period.
My understanding is the gap is not only for, say, from January now. It would be, initially you talked about 3 years.
And the point is that, and that's where you need a collective will to actually say, we know that the one database, and if you're talking about the human resources development, they're also going to need a database. And I think that that's something that the portfolio committee can actually take up, and we can make sure that we can crack this one. It's eminently doable, and we don't need hundreds of millions of rand. It's a relatively manageable budget. This is something new in terms of professional bodies. In terms of the Act, SACWA will recognize professional bodies for the purposes of the NQF Act and to register their professional designations on the NQF. Now, what does this mean? If you ask how many engineers are there in training in South Africa, you'd have to go to the 13 universities that train engineers, and you would have to then find out how many in first year, second year, third, fourth year. And it's a lot of PT to do that. Whereas if you started to collect that and you knew how many professional engineers are actually active or registered on the professional register, then we would have the data all in one place. That is possible, and the professional bodies are working with us again, we need to consult with the QCs. We have already got a draft document, and again, there's the problem of the QCTO, but we're going to move on that one immediately. In terms of the quality council, they have to include professional bodies in the quality assurance and qualification development, and there is a responsibility on all of us to consult with the professional bodies, and we've got a good track record of working with the Health Professions Council, the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, the Nursing Council, etc. So I think there's a lot of work that's been done there. Then in terms of international relationships, I just think that the chair has addressed that in her opening remarks. This is the unrecognized jewel in the South African crown of education and training. And I think it's time that it got center stage and that our government got the kind of recognition for what it does. I think, if I can just add one word to what the chair said, it's that the way in which we talk about our NQF is very sophisticated and nuanced. It's not just a technicist thing that we're introducing. It's something that has been very accountable, very reflective, and very bold. And so, in fact, we are at the conceptual cutting edge of NQF internationally. And for this committee, just to say that it was rumored that Canada would never have a national qualification framework. It's on the cards for Canada. And in the United States, the Lumina Foundation has just launched a conversation around a qualification framework in the United States. So I think there's an international chair mentioned the figure of 100. I was at a conference where people were saying there's about 150 countries. So one of our researchers is looking to actually do the number count so we can have an accurate figure there. And then this is some additional responsibilities that we have to advise the ministers to do the verification service, as was mentioned previously. And then, of course, there are these, what you call these weasel clauses. We can perform any other function required by the NQF Act if it's not there. And we can perform any function consistent with the NQF determined by the minister. So the minister can, in fact, give us instructions if it's consistent with the Act. And again, similarly, the quality councils have to have that function. Chair, that's where I want to end. I want to hand over to my colleague, Joe Samuel, to talk about the recognition of findings.
Any questions from members of the staff? Yeah, Member Jones.
Well, thank you, Chairperson. What I want to know is, you know, in life, some people acquire knowledge through a number of years working in a particular place. For instance, let me take a person who has been working for an electronic company for 25 years, and he has acquired quite a lot of knowledge. He's just professional. And for one reason or the other, this person finds himself or herself ejected out of employment, and he doesn't have a certificate to prove that he knows the work, and he comes to you and say, look, I have this knowledge, and I'm asking you to assess my ability and recognize my knowledge by awarding me the certificate if you are satisfied about what I know. Would you do that? And furthermore, how do you actually advertise yourself to your principal clients in various communities so that people know that you are there and they can come to you? Thank you.
Chair, my colleague, Joe Sam, is going to deal with that in a lot more detail. But let me just say and continue where the chair left off about the difficulty about the recognition of prior learning. She dealt very well on the issue about an unfair funded mandate. But because the recognition of prior learning can give a person a qualification, there is always this tendency to think about what is the creditworthiness of that qualification. And so there's always this notion between, is it a valid qualification? So in a sense, RPL is sometimes its own undoing. People don't want to trust it. So it is possible for the trades, for people to do a challenge test. But even under our existing laws in the mining industry, people qualify, they pass the trade test, but the mines won't employ them. So there's a lot more that has to happen. And maybe that when we said the two things that's doable, career advice services plus the RPL, maybe one of the moves that we have to do is to establish, maybe start with three regional centers where you can have these RPL centers. At the moment, they do exist for the trade, but it's not integrated back into the workplace. So when I speak to the mines, I say to them, it's fine for you to say we won't employ Section 28 qualified workers. I said, but if you have a problem with either the creditworthiness or the quality or whatever, let's fix the system so that people have a second chance. But I suspect there's a whole lot of other social uses of qualifications in terms of inclusion and exclusion that's playing themselves up behind the scenes. And there could be even another form of job reservation that is taking place. So I think and that's where the research into work and learning will unpack that. But I'm sure my colleague will deal with that in more detail.
Well, Chair, my question will relate to these professional bodies that you just mentioned. You find it difficult to register some of these professionals. I don't know if I caught you clearly, but you said even the council itself, they find it very difficult that they able to track and register these professionals, like for instance engineers, that you find them, that you can be able to track how many engineers that we have. I'm trying to say, if you can be able to have this relationship between these councils and these other professional bodies, what makes you find it difficult to have this database of those professionals?
Is there anyone else? Member Nalucha?
You want me to ask? Thanks to the professor and Sam. In my mind, I battle. I was in higher education before.
Just the mic, please.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Thanks, Chancellor. I've always battled with where to place quality assurance in the production line of knowledge. I've never known whether it informs content or when content is there, it evaluates it and validates it. So I really would like to see where in the production line quality assurance is. Secondly, and I know there are lots of other factors around to inform the social context, but you have a quality assurance outfit, for lack of a better qualification. Why is it a status issue for universities, or is it a content issue that a certificate from VET or UCT would, or a learner from UCT would be more readily employed than a learner where I taught at Walter University? Is it the content? Is it the quality? Where are you when learners have got this qualification and are on the marketplace? And lastly, the rural village where I was born, how would they ever know? In other words, again, I'm placing it in the production line, be it the production is content or context. How far do you take? What is your outreach? How do you get known? It sounds pretty, it's a system, but I miss processing people in the whole context.
Mm. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Just a few of the questions. The first one relates to the statistics or data management. That the gap you referred to about the 3 years and so on. I'm just wondering whether, obviously within the individual institutions, there may be no major problem, they've got that. But perhaps that relates to those institutions informing other stakeholders. But my area of interest will be whether that is able to feed back to government, because government, for instance, has to, through NS staff, has to actually fund those who can't afford to be in those institutions. May it be that if there's a problem with that, that government may be funding even bodies, own bodies who are not there, or where can it be a problem? Or it's not a problem for these institutions to inform government for purposes of these bursary schemes and so on. But I know that there were challenges of whether this high drop rate, I would use the drop rate still in terms of those, whether it's actually correct or not. We had such questions. But the second, just in terms of operation, do the quality council sort of, in terms of the national qualifications framework, sort of equal to SAQA, or what is the relation? Because every time you're talking mutual relationship, collaboration, and all that, who has got authority over who? Or you all account equally? You know, there's no higher body in terms of those particular relations. The third, the one on trade and occupation, it's like it's not there now, and there's a great need or urgent need for it to be established. Who has to facilitate that process for it to be quicker, or where is the delay? Why can't we be able to see a move of some kind? But also, whether there's any relationship with CITAS in terms of that. The very last one, there was a quality debate, a quality of education debate not long. Where were you in that kind of debate? Were you just quiet, silent, and you don't think you feature, or did you have a stake in terms of what should happen? Yes, let me just, I just hope I'm understood without elaborating much.
Good. Let's get to the sponsors. I think what as a committee, some of us do strongly believe that there is a serious problem with information management on education in this country. Mm. That we've now spoken to NSFAS, we've spoken to different institutions. We are hearing from you also that your database, which is possibly one of the best in our space, is actually 3 or 4 years old. With various degrees of, and because they're dependable. We've heard from NSFAS not so long ago that, and from ESA, that 40% of people are drop out, and you've got a different word thought between that's what academics do and so on. But, and I understand the reasoning behind your terminology, because it's not out of free will necessarily. But we can't even say where these people are.
Now, and therefore you can't find a strategy of catching them again. And that's only, for example, on those that have left, even those that are in the system. So it is. I think there is a serious problem with whoever is in the education sphere, with executive, departmental authority, as well as with the institutions like yourself, around the quality of that information management. And I think some of the points that the last member made speaks to those issues. It's something that we obviously want to take forward, because it seems to me it's more systemic by nature than, for example, this institution. And there was a lot of, and it shows the fragmentation, I think, even in our system. And hopefully through a restructured model, when it comes to our education and training, we're going to have to reflect on that as a critical element. But over to yourself.
I'll just start with a couple of points. I think that the question of where quality should sit is it should sit across the entire system. So every institution which registers a qualification, it needs to check who's teaching, whether there's support for the learners, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there are multiple places in any institution where quality is checked. And in the last sort of 5 years or so, we've now got system, well, in fact, the last 3 years, say within higher education, you've got these institutional audits and this sort of thing where the system is being looked at as a whole. So I think that quality assurance is something that needs to be thought about at every step of the way. It's not something that you just get to at the end. It's your quality of teaching and learning, which is absolutely key. It's your quality of advising. Have you got the right people in that right institution? So, you know, who should be in universities? Who should be in further education colleges? Who should be out there in the workplace and so on and so forth? So I think quality isn't just one. Quality is a process. But what we have instituted are key moments in which institutions are being assessed as a whole, and certainly from the higher education side. I think that we have made a lot of mistakes in terms of how we've thought about things. My personal view is that we imagine, for instance, that you can train an assessor of workplace learning within 2 to 5 days. I think this is a complete fallacy, that we've dumbed down our understanding of what it means to be a professional, of what it means to be a professional person who's able to assess. And you know, you get all sorts of adverts, which, and people have been doing it, and they make their living out of it, you know, running these things. You can't tell me that after 2 to 5 days with no education and training background, particular background, you can be an assessor. And so there's a lot of rethinking around this, which I think is necessary. We've kind of we've really got a little bit into the quick and dirty kind of approach in some ways in the system, and it's very uneven. The other thing which I'd like to point to is about you're a portfolio development, a portfolio committee of Parliament. You know that this is about politics, and it's not just a technical issue as to who recognizes what qualifications. It's political. And that's why, in fact, the book that we've just gifted you on learning and work, it really raises the issue of the politics of what the relationship between learning and work is. And we have examples from around the world which show why black lawyers, for instance, in the UK, struggle to get particular kinds of qualifications and recognition, for instance. It's not just a South African issue, but politics is real in terms of gender, in terms of disability, in terms of region, and so on and so forth. And often one is rather glib about how to solve the problems. One's not addressing the political issues that really underpin this whole area. So it's not a technical debate. The other thing, just the third point I'd like to make as a general point, is that while we are now saying it's the learners who matter, it's the learners who we have to worry about, it's those learners in Limpopo or rural Eastern Cape or whatever, and those teachers, how do they get their information? They don't. And that's why we're saying we need a national helpline which is based on cell phone technology, because 80% of the people across this country in rural and urban areas have access to cell phones. So we need to use that kind of technology. But that's the way you're going to get there. Yeah, and through use of radio and so on. But you need some kind of interactive media which enables people to get access. And so in the dialogues that we've been having, we in fact had someone from northern KwaZulu-Natal in a village somewhere and trying to bring that reality into this debate. It's not just about the urban centers, and we know that. So I think that you've pointed to some absolutely key things. It is about politics. It is about people and how qualifications are used to keep people in and keep them out. Professional councils do the same thing. You're in, you're out, you're a man, you're a woman, you're black, you're white, you're this, you're that, whatever. We have to be real, you know, and I think recognizing it, and I hope that some of you will sort of dip into some of the materials we've given you, because it's really to try to make these discussions a lot more not complex for their own sake, but in fact more interesting. And I think I'll just stop there.
I will just add that, you know, you can use statistics to prove anything, even the truth. And I think that part of the problem why we don't put the statistics right up front is because people have already started to say, how is this going to make me look, or us look, or them look, or whatever. So I think the issue is we have to be transparent with our statistics and let people make the sums that they want to make, because that's the way we're going to move forward. The issue about the professional bodies, information is also money. So very often people want to guard their lists. And the main thing about the professional bodies is they'll tell you who's paid their fees and who's registered as a professional nurse or a professional doctor. We just had the Health Professions Council on the radio about people who's going to do ops and they're not registered anymore because they haven't paid their fees. So very often it's all those other nuances that bedevils me. What we're saying is we want to know who is a qualified doctor and are they practicing medicine, for example. There are people who qualify as engineers, but they're doing all other things than building bridges and fixing computers and other things. So it's about getting the information current. Again, cell phone technology, the issue about where are people. At the conference in Washington, they've been using a technology called LinkUp that, in fact, can now trace where people are. So this thing about someone at university left the university and the university is trying to say, what is the person doing now? That used to be a very costly exercise. But it's now with the cell phone technology, there's ways to do it quite cheaply. I just maybe want to make a general point. Mm-hmm. Is that we're making some fundamental errors. Now, for example, to take what the chairperson mentioned about data, I think we can fix the data thing fairly quickly. But then we must have someone who takes accountability for that, that we avoid the meddling, because, you know, if it's a big new database, lots of people want to compete for that contract. There's procurement policies. Everybody sees it in different kinds of ways. And, in fact, what we lose out in the end, and there's a classical example now of one government department that is going to put in a database that's linked to our national learner's record database. And I'm at a meeting and they say they're going to give it to this particular firm. And I said, this is the same firm that has messed up your other database. Now, how can you give the contract to the same? No, but we've got an agreement. There's a public-private partnership. Now, it's that kind of nonsense that has to be. And so I think there's some honest broking and some truth-telling, and people feel you know, one can get accused of all kinds of things. You talk out of a meeting. You know, but if you want to get this thing right, somebody has to take responsibility. And I think for the education database, if the portfolio committee can be a champion, you'll find there's a lot of people to want to support you. Over to
Chairperson, quite a lot has been said, you know, about RTL already.
Sorry, Chair. There was a question the Chair of SACWA reminded me about the hierarchy of SACWA and the QCs. Now, I think that different people are playing it in different ways. But in the run-up to the NQF, people were saying that SACWA is the apex organization. And a number of senior government people, politicians and civil servants, came to SACWA meetings to put that position forward. I think the real question about who is the senior is not sorted out just by a matter of someone ranking. It's also by the quality of the work that the body does. And so we're very mindful of it. And so we'd rather play, we collaborate, we'll do this, and hopefully exercise our leadership in it. But I think it goes back to the question about somebody has to be accountable for it, and we must try and avoid lots of too much messing.
Can I then also excuse my name, Magaza? I think you need to go to a very important engagement as well, related to another portfolio. Am I right?
Sir, I didn't want to take much time. It's fine, I hear that there's no clarity exactly. People will just lay it out later on, perhaps it will sort it itself and so on. Whether that will happen, I'm not sure. But then there are just two others that I feel are not also responded to. The one on who should facilitate a quick establishment of the trade and occupation one. And the last was on the quality debate that learners can't write, read, or comprehend anything, and where were you located in that debate, or what became your position, or you were just quiet and you didn't want to partake in that.
The QCTO can be established fairly quickly. SACWA had both quality assurance and standard setting. The chair and myself have had meetings with the acting DGs of labor to try and move that process forward. And I think that they've gone down a particular pathway where they didn't want to sign a memorandum of understanding to fast-track it. And now with the proclamation of the function moving to the Ministry of Higher Education and Training, hopefully that the new ministry will give strong leadership in that direction. But SACWA remains willing to move that process along if it's given the mandate to do that. In terms of the quality debate, we don't believe in meddling when we can play a constructive role in a number of other things. We are concerned about the quality of our schooling, quality in FET colleges, the quality in higher education. And we have produced a number of reports. But let me show you how we go about working at that. The private schools are very concerned about the National Senior Certificate and what status that holds internationally. So we're working with the IEB and UMALUSI and the department. SACWA is trying to facilitate the discussion so that they want to get NARIC UK, which is a body that does evaluation internationally, to benchmark our national senior certificate. Now, you can imagine the political sensitivity of something like that and the way in which this could create a problem. So SACWA is there working without making a fanfare. I grew up with the saying, ons raas nie, ons plaas nie, maar ons verkoop ons vis.
I missed
moving
that.
Moving quietly forward. That's what they're saying.
I'm in the Western
Cape. Sounds colloquial
expression. Chairperson, thank you very much. Quite a lot has been said about RPL already by, you know, by the chair. I think, you know, the first slide really talks about the progress that has been made in South Africa. And I think if one looks at the slide, to a large extent, it says that we have learned quite a lot. Firstly, we've put RPL on the agenda of a post-apartheid South Africa. And also we've, you know, developed a number of capacities and so on. We also understand, you know, the kind of area much better. I think the chair also mentioned a number of areas where, you know, people thought it was going to be easy, you know, to do and so on. And when, you know, when one actually hits the implementation and so on, you actually realize that, you know, things are not as easy as it seems. And so, you know, so we've learned quite a bit, you know, over the last, 10 years or so. The executive officer spoke about quite a lot of research that has, that has been going on, and in particular, dealing with, researching precisely, what is it, how one can actually move forward in terms of RPL, and we've got the particular relationship that we've set up with the University of the Western Cape. Then there's also been attempts made at, implementing RPL at the mass scale. And here are a number of examples, that have been mentioned. The National Professional Diploma in Education, where teachers, where there was the upgrading of underqualified teachers. You know, that has been quite a big process, and in particular, a number of universities have been involved with that. The University of Free State is one example, as well as UNISA. Then the URBC example is also one, and, the chair spoke about that, and there's also then, the book that was handed out. The South African police also tried, to do it, and in particular looking at, how their senior staff members could be empowered, as well as the SNDF. Now, another big project was the insurance area, where through the FIES Act, there were particular kinds of requirements for them, and between about 20,000 to 75,000 people, in fact, went through that particular process. Also in construction, there was a big process. And so in all of these different MASCAL projects, there has been a number of valuable lessons learned out of that. The more recent one that I don't have on the slide was in terms of people involved with selling property and so on, that quite a lot of money was also put in terms of that. As it were, again, it seems to be one of the key lessons coming out of that is if there are particular kinds of legislative requirements, it seems like that kind of drives the process forward. And I mean, that's an important lesson that one can learn. Now, we have participated with the OECD in a study that dealt with quite a number of countries, and one of the key things that comes out of the OECD report, and I think the chair mentioned this earlier, is that in South Africa there are a number of isolated pockets of excellence. But in general, I mean, there's quite a lot of work that needs to be done. And I've got a slide later on where, South Africa is placed within a kind of broad frame to say where is it that we are in, if one looks kind of globally, and I get back to that a little bit later on. So what are some of the key benefits of RPL? And I'm going to go quickly through this because I think, this committee, has raised a number of questions, in fact, and, quite clearly in people's minds there are a number of benefits, involved in this. So, one of the benefits, I mean, the issue about cost, we were saying earlier, one of the key things, in fact, is that initially it was the idea that it would be a cheap option. option, in fact, but in fact, you know, it doesn't necessarily, you know, is the case. And in fact, you know, there is no systematic RPL funding, which you mentioned that earlier. Also, that RPL is contextual is, you know, is an important lesson that we've learned. There are a number of catalysts, you know, that clearly needs to be identified. And then also, if we want to address RPL, we actually need to look at the inhibitors. You know, what are the kinds of things that really, you know, play a role in, you know, in us not moving forward to where one wants to be. The challenges. Now, there are a number of known challenges in the system. For example, there are gaps in our statutory framework. And if I can just... if I can just mention, you know, just kind of one or two, you know, of some of this stuff. That we, although there are RPL requirements, for example, with our quality assurance bodies, but in fact there are a number of insufficient follow-throughs in terms of the RPL plans and so on, you know, that is required. And there's no follow-through regarding implementation. There are also some statute requirements in terms of public and private higher education institutions that inhibit the implementation of RPL. You know, for example, when there are non-traditional applicants, you know, that encourage to come through, but they still need to satisfy the matric exemption requirements for national senior certificate, for example, and that, you know, causes, you know, quite a lot of a big barrier. Also, I mean, there's a policy, for example, that if you go into higher education, that only 50% of your credits will be recognized. And in fact, that 50% of new work still needs to be done. So what I'm saying, those are just some examples, you know, that needs to be dealt with. Earlier, the executive officer spoke about the idea of RPL centers, you know, that these centers only provide assessment services, but they are not recognized because they're not offering a full qualification, as an example. So those are just a few examples of, you know, some of the barriers that needs to be removed. We also need to build on best practice, you know, as one is going forward. And then I think the other big thing that we need to do is to promote, you know, the real high-quality RPL, because if you don't do that, in actual fact, then people are getting shortchanged, you know, and they go through a process, and again, in fact, they are then let down, you know, if we don't make sure that the practices and the kinds of stuff that they get into, you know, is of a high quality. So possible way forward, firstly, is that we are suggesting that we need to address the gaps in terms of the statutory framework. We need to, again, look at the question about viable funding mechanisms, and I think the Chair, you know, alluded to, you know, to that. We also believe that we need to drive a mechanism for enhancing and measuring progress in RPL, and one of the ideas, in fact, is to establish a kind of national RPL association so that we can, on a consistent basis, get together at the national level. We need to develop a wider range of credible RPL assessment methods and instruments, you know, so that people don't, you know, don't get shortchanged, and we need to disseminate, you know, that quite widely. We also believe that we need to encourage and facilitate the formation of partnerships for delivery, you know, across the system, coordinate the addressing of specific challenges in higher education, further education, industry, and organized labor. And in particular, I think, you know, this committee deals with now higher education and training, and I think that is quite an important, you know, linkage there. Coordinate and ask for information and advocacy campaign, we believe, is quite important, you know, so that we can get the information out, you know, into, you know, quite a number of areas that hasn't been, you know, reached and so on. Then also coordinate RPL research and integrate the findings into the RPL processes, and then support notice advisory services across the country. So those are some of the thoughts that we think about going forward. I had spoken earlier about the OECD report, and if one looks at the kind of, you know, map that they've outlined as to where particular countries would be, the one is, you would see, the you know, where the one has got, you know, what is the model, the characteristics in the country, and you would see that, you know, there's a, you know, if one is going to, there's a kind of, at the moment there's a quasi system, and then you have an inclusive policy, and in there you have Ireland, Netherlands, Denmark, and Norway, and then a set of consistent practices. Now, South Africa, you know, with a vision, Australia, Canada, South Africa, UK, and Belgium, you know, falls within, you know, falls within there. So in other words, we are not, if one looks at it internationally, we are not, you know, the worst of the two, because if one looks at the bottom, there's nothing and so on. So, you know, we have made progress, and I think we need to state that very often, you know, what we do, we always focus on the negative. We actually made, you know, quite a lot of progress, as it were. So the key thing now is what are the kind of next steps, and as I said, we've outlined some of the things that we can do, you know, moving forward. Chair, maybe I should stop there and ask, you know, if, you know, are there any questions and so on.
No, no, let's not do that.
Okay.
Let's go to
the next one,
one, and then we'll do the round.
Okay, thanks. Chair, the other question that we needed to address was, you know, dealing with unregistered colleges and the use of irregular qualifications. Now, I first of all want to start by saying that, you know, SACWA's got a number of brand values, and it is outlined, you know, in terms of that. But, I mean, the key point there is that we are saying that one of the key things that we need to do is to, you know, through our advocacy, you know, and we have got an advocacy campaign that is ready to roll, which is saying what is fake and what is authentic, what is genuine, what is fake and so on. So the idea, in fact, is that, you know, we will be, you know, we'll be rolling out this, you know, this campaign so that the public, in a certain sense, know exactly, you know, what are some of those, you know, providers, you know, that are not, you know, genuine, as it were, and which one are fake. And so, you know, you know, we can speak a little bit about it later. One of the frustrations at the moment is that we can't roll it out because, you know, all these different systems are not, you know, operative and so on. And it seems like, you know, there's a sense that says we need to hold back, you know, before we actually roll out, you know, this campaign, you know, to the public. In terms of current activities, what we do we have registered quite a number of trademarks in terms of logos, you know, particular kind of names like SACWA, you know, what accreditation means and all of those kinds of stuff. And if people transgress that, we're actually following it up legally, you know, so that's what we do, and we then deal with those particular providers. SACWA is also part of an initiative by the Department of Education and Training, and in fact, the meeting was called last, you know, 2 weeks ago. That focuses particularly on the pursuing unscrupulous providers. In terms of that initiative, the NPA, the SAPS, and all the other quality councils are also part of that process, and this is our coordinated way in which, you know, one will be dealing with it. But quite clearly, you know, if, for example, there are unscrupulous providers, the idea is that criminal proceedings will be initiated by them, by the Department of Education and Training. We also were saying that it is quite important to ensure that all the providers are, you know, are quality assured. In that sense, all the quality councils and SACWA will be working together in terms of that. Then we also have, you know, those foreign... the foreign qualifications, SACWA got a particular responsibility in terms of that, and, you know, that is what we are bringing to the party, and that, as well as the interaction with DTI to ensure that, you know, some of these private providers are registered. So that is a whole initiative, in fact, that we are involved in, you know, going forward. There will be another meeting that we will be calling, you know, to map out the particular strategy and the kind of implementation of that, you know, nationally. Then, Chair, we've also been part of a series of meetings with people internationally, and this is a set of proposals that have been made in terms of how one deals with this, not only at the national basis, but also internationally, because there are quite a number of foreign universities and other providers that provide cross-border education and so on, and quite a number of them are also unscrupulous providers. So the agreement, in fact, you know, with UNESCO as well as with the Council on Education accreditation in the U.S., you know, this is the kind of plans, you know, moving forward. This is firstly to create tools for identification of unscrupulous providers, and here particularly, if one looks at the kind of legal systems and so on in the different countries, to make sure that you can identify them clearly without harming, you know, those ones that really produce good work. And I mean, that is a kind of balance that one needs to, you know, needs to take into account. Also, that what one needs to do is to use evidence of quality provided by acknowledged competent authorities on academic quality, so that one can actually say to the general public, these are the people that you should actually be going to and not to the others. Thirdly, that one is to encourage providers of public and private funding to avoid funding unscrupulous providers and their students. Because in some cases, people go into partnerships, you know, with a number of, you know, a number of these providers and so on. And then it's very difficult because what they do is then they say, we are linked to provider X and, you know, and then use, you know, that as a way of hoodwinking the public. I'd spoken earlier about the information to the public about, you know, who those providers are, then also to pursue legal action against the providers and the use of their fraudulent credentials, and of course, as I said, the focus on cross-border unscrupulous providers. Chairperson, that concludes the presentation.
Thank you. I'll allow for questions from members. Just a question. Is this last section about unregistered colleges and irregular qualifications is a big problem? How big is this problem?
Chair, there hasn't, in a certain sense, I mean, you know, there hasn't been a study that is done that would say, you know, these are the numbers and so on. You know, what happens is that both the Department of Education, you know, follow up, you know, as soon as, you know, as, you know, a number of these providers are coming, you know, are reported, as it were. But, you know, there hasn't been a kind of proactive stance and a proactive unit that has been set up to actually go out and to seek, you know, out all of these providers. And I think part of the strategy going forward was to say that we actually need to be much more proactive about this rather than being reactive and only wait until, you know, people report, you know, this to us.
What responsibility would that be?
At the moment, the Department of Education is driving, you know, that because in terms of the legislation, the department is responsible for the registration, you know, particularly of private providers.
Clearly one can see a link between if there's a mass number of these types of colleges or service providers, and then some of the concerns about our quality of education. Clearly there's an issue there. So I do think we need to, as a committee, take it up with the education department around a much more proactive approach to this. I think it can't just be because somebody had a bad experience and therefore it registered and therefore it's followed up. Something not right in there. Members? Member Kupai? Dr. James?
Thanks, Chair. I just want to speak on the latter part of the presentation, especially coming from Gauteng, which is one of the areas where this is a bit of a problem of colleges which are unregistered, operating illegally, and all that. But, you see, Chair, one of the problems that I would want to check is that, because some of these colleges is one of those who have come registered with SAQA, and somehow in the process they fell off. And then instead of being discontinued, they continue with, you know, providing the service without even going back to renew that. And also they've been found, because it's what I know is that most of them, it's not like that they just woke up and operated without having even in touch with SAQA. My concern is that linkage to say when a qualification, for example, has been registered and it's at the point where it is deregistered or it does not exist anymore with SAQA, what level of follow-ups does from that side happen to ensure that institutions don't continue and provide training around that qualification, for example. That's one. But again, I think the latter part that you spoke about on proactive measures to ensure that it's not about members reporting, members of community reporting about these institutions. Most of them are known, are out there, but nothing has been done about them. You know, there are a number of them in Gauteng, in Johannesburg specifically. They are there, they exist, but it seems like, you know, there's a fertile soil created for them to operate. And unless a person has been fully informed to say there's this type of a thing, then, I mean, it happened even with schools, basic schools. To find somebody operating a school, at a building, and then when it's time for parents to come sometime, then there's no more people, they've relocated. So I'm just worried about that, to say, how do we, because we spoke about even issues of proactive measures, but how do we anticipate, when do we anticipate to put in that in plan? Perhaps maybe from your side as a quality assurer or the quality assuring authorities as well, we have to engage with the department because it has an implication in the level of what you offer as qualifications, as because it does an impact anyway. So, and the other thing that I have a bit of a concern, the presentation sort of focused on what we want to do going forward somehow, but doesn't give me a sense of the issues, you know, from, you know, what extent have we been able to take a legal action against an institution, what happened. Do we have such examples? Because you might find that what is created as a fertile soil is because there's never been an action taken against anyone. And therefore, even if it's taken, it's hidden, it's not known so that people can know that literally if I do this, I open a school, I operate illegally, I can be arrested. So if that's why I'm asking that question in that context, to say, previously, what happened, what have been the issues, how we dealt with them, did we manage to get it into the public so that we can... But again, around even creating the public, I'm going back to what Member Makubela was raising around when there are public domain discussions. Was that sometimes creates a platform for even SAQA to raise these things, to alert the public. But if we take what you said, say, around... taking a step back and just doing things quietly. Sometimes it might not work because it's in the public domain. We need to engage. We need to make sure that as part of informing the public, we need to make sure that people know what is right and what is wrong and where the stance and what is true, what is factual, and what is really not factual. So from my side, I would love to see SAQA actually becoming part of the public domain discussions, not being at the background and sitting quietly. It does not assist the country at all.
I just wanted to ask a very general question about your relationship to innovations in knowledge. And let me just use one example that I've been working on. Most music schools, this is at university level, would typically offer courses to students where they learn to play an instrument in a conservatory, and they will also take a course in the history of music and related subjects. There's a recent innovation that comes out of biology, which is to understand how the brain functions in terms of receiving musical notes. And you would know from your experience that the brain is immensely sensitive to, say, a drop in a semitone in a musical score. And it can make you very sad when it happens. Right? And musical writers know that. And the fact is that the brain pumps out about 60 chemicals in response to musical patterns. And we all vary in our brain wiring. So some of us like jazz, and some of us like classical music, and so on. So any student in the world of music needs to understand what the recent science is of neurology when it comes to the recognition of musical patterns of sound. So a good degree in music, in fact, does both. And if you look at the best practice on this in the US, in the UK, and some European institutions, they require students to take a double major in music and neurology, so the brain science. So how do you that's just an example, but how do you stand as a qualifications authority against the content of degrees where the content is in fact changing very rapidly? And that old patterns and old ways of looking at things, in fact, require a new set of categories. I don't want to really get into the example, but the story around Casta and her sexual orientation is another example. I don't think her sexual orientation is a subject for public discussion myself. I think it's absolutely wrong that it happened. But the science of it, just to talk about that, the science of it indicates that we are in fact dimorphic, that is, we're either male or female, and that's illustrated by having a reproductive biology that separates us as a dimorphic species. Some species are self-fertilizing, and there are some species with four sexes. Okay, we could too. But there are gray areas there. And those gray areas are either an expression of natural variation in being female, so some women are a bit more male-like, doesn't make them male. And some men, as we know, are more female-like, it doesn't make them female. And then it's the question of being hermaphroditic, and then there's a question of transsexuality and so on. So this is a frontier science, though. We don't know all the answers. And when it comes to gender studies at university, students should know that, science. That is, they mustn't just get the idea that we make up gender as we, you know, take a shower in the morning. That it actually has a biological foundation. It's a frontier science. But if I believe students at university should get the best knowledge about a place in the universe today, and if they don't get it, they're not getting quality. If they're getting half of it, they're not getting quality. So I'm sorry, I'm being a bit long-winded, but how do you stand in relation to the content of the content part of knowledge in trying to fix quality at this moment in our history?
Anyone else? No? Thank you, Chair. I understand that institutions have to register courses to be able to, or register a qualification, which obviously would be checked against some kind of a quality assurance. But do the institutions themselves have any, or does the SAQA have any mandate to look at the quality of the actual institution itself to get it registered, which would tie into, I think, both of those questions?
Thanks, sir. The doctor here was going deep into the science. But then mine is one that establishes the actual mandate that we've got. If I got it right, you were saying the Department of Education is the one that has got authority over those illegal institutions and so on. But at the same time, you're saying the way forward is that as SAQA you should pursue legal action, unless if that was meant for the department. So I was just trying to check whether you can, is it within your own mandate you can pursue that, or it will literally be a wish that may not be realized, you know. But that also links with the question that came earlier to saying, has there been any action taken, or people are doing all this with impunity? So whether we are able to enforce that. I think the other time we engaged with this issue ourselves to check in exactly who are supposed to do what, because nobody seems to be acting. And as this person is not within anyone's right to do it, or it's just left like that and then becomes some fertile ground within which people can just do as they please. You know, today they close, they establish another name somewhere else, they proceed, and we just seem to be, they are criminals basically, and it's like government is unable to act. you know, and they are before us, and we can't explain that ourselves. But when we try to locate the institution that has to come forward and act, at times it's becoming like a blur. Yeah, that's right.
I also want to welcome Member Mashwana to our meeting. Shall we hand over to yourself?
I'll answer part of it, then I'll hand over to the chair and to the deputy. I think the problem that's faced with how do you offer a good quality qualification is a very interesting one and a very pertinent one. The way, now again, you must bear in mind that SACWU did have standard setting responsibility, it now doesn't have going forward. But we believe that even going forward, the quality council is going to have a system where they have panels of experts who come together and say a music degree should have this, a degree in gender studies should have that. And so the way the panel is constituted is important. The work of that expert panel is important, that the work is made public. The people, both in terms of their communities of practice, can be inputting into that debate, and individuals can input in that debate. And then a final determination is made. In terms of the system as it's going to go forward, each QC would have a responsibility for their sub-framework, and the South African Qualifications Authority would have a responsibility for ensuring that those qualifications that are recommended for registration meet that requirement. And that is something that we are going to have to agree on as what that process is going to be. The old legislation, the SACWU Act, made it quite clear that we could only register qualifications that were internationally comparable. And that was a very important requirement. So we couldn't just register anything. We had to be able to say, what does it compare to what other international qualifications were? And I think that's an important, and I think that will continue to go forward. But I think it's the quality of that debate that's also going to determine the quality of our qualifications framework. So I think it's we're well on the way to, in fact, doing that. The question about why are there still unscrupulous providers, it goes back to the other point, why don't we have all the data? If the minister issued an instruction to SACWU, follow up on this, and here is the mandate and the money to do it, we could do it. Or they said it to the Department of Higher Education and Training, we want you to do this, establish a unit, here's your budget, go and do it. So I think that the auditing function of providers is a quality council matter. And I think that we must sort out who the responsibility is and give the group a mandate. And I think that as we want to have enlightened government, it doesn't mean that everything has to be in one department. It could be that the best body to do this function now is here, but in 5 years' time you may want to move that function somewhere else. So I think there is the issue is one of governance, and the portfolio committee is well placed to actually make some recommendations about who should get which mandate, and then we can proceed.
Can I just add one small point? I think that lack of information flow is a major problem. So when there's an unscrupulous provider, there isn't a system at the moment whereby a system which helps, in a way, uncontaminated information flow. The kinds of information systems we have at this point, they're people who are either promoting themselves or promoting their products. And part of what we're trying to do with a national helpline, which is a careers advice service, is about saying you would then have a neutral body. So if you find that College X is actually a shyster, then that information can get passed to people who are phoning in. At the moment, there is no in a way, clearinghouse of data of this kind. It's really very localized and so on. So I think that a lot of these issues, the better your information flow in a society, the stronger the society, because then actually people can make up their own minds too, because they have accurate information. They're not just being sold a particular line. So I think that there are a number of reasons why we should work quite hard to get a national initiative which is widely available across the country, so that you can get this data flowing. Because no matter how much policing you're going to do, you're never going to be doing enough policing. But certainly through word of mouth, that's where your information is not always accurate, but often that's how people learn about things. So if you have a system which is trying to be a clearinghouse of key information about education and training providers, qualifications, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, people can at least have a chance to get this information. So I think we really have to not see it just as a policing operation, but as somewhere where we're trying to get that information, quality information flowing through the country.
Yeah, Chairperson, let me just respond to this view that we don't talk to the public and we only do things because we do things in a particular way, but we also speak to the public. In fact, 2 weeks ago, SACWA was on national television talking about unscrupulous providers and so on. And it's a series of a whole number. Over the last number of years, there's been a number of programs where publicly we've actually, had spoken about that and pointed out to the general public, what they should be looking out for. So really just to clear that. The second issue was in terms of what we are doing and what it is that we will be doing. I have said that in terms of a number of what we've done is we've registered a number of trademarks and so on, and we're following that up in terms of dealing with a number of lawyers and so on to follow up on those ones. But I want to make a distinction, in fact, between SACWA's responsibility and that of the Department of Education, that we are concerned about the accreditation of institutions, and the Department of Education registers, those particular providers. So what I'm saying, there is a difference there. And I've also made the point that the department, is now forming a more proactive stance and trying to pursue, some of that, and then, I've spoken quite at length about the initiative that was taken, but quite clearly, in fact, I don't think it was it's adequate. We actually need to have this proactive, stance, moving forward. I also want to agree with the chairperson to say that quite a lot of it is about getting the information out to people in a systematic way and saying to them, these are the kinds of providers, these are the signs that one should be looking for, these are the kind of questions that you should be asking and so on, so that you don't get into, going to those providers in the first instance. And I think, it is a kind of link between the policing on the one hand and making a number of very public examples of people on the one hand, but also providing information on a more consistent, systematic basis.
I think my question was not answered. Has there been an institution that was found guilty or anything done?
Chair, let me say that under the old SACWA Act, SACWA was responsible for accrediting the education and training quality assurance bodies, of which there were 31. We have deaccredited, correct term, a PSETA, for example, after they did not do their work correctly. There were a number of providers that were deaccredited by these 31 EQA bodies. There were a number of appeals that were made to SACWA around these issues, in which, in fact, all the appeals that we heard The appeals were dismissed because the providers were de-accredited, and there's a record of that. So, it's a record that is public.
I just want to comment on SACWA's silence on these bogus schools operating everywhere in the country, that this actually impacts negatively on the society, in that the schools reap of unsuspecting parents of a lot of money, and children's time get wasted. Some of these schools started grade 8, and they will have a license number to say that we are registered. They have a registration number, which is actually false. It is only when the school has to administer the grade 12 examination that everybody will realize that this has been actually a bogus school, because it has no registration number and children cannot write exams. And it means children have lost 5 years of their life, and parents have lost a lot of money. And I think this is a fraud, and these schools, the owners of these schools, can be taken to court. They cannot just be left, and SACWA cannot just keep quiet and say we operate silently. Thanks.
I sort of know in the old act you said you were responsible for accreditation. Who's responsible now for?
The Quality Council.
Chair, I think we must distinguish between strategy and tactics. If SACWA is going to jump up for every issue like this, it is in fact going to undo the good that it can do. The SACWA is not silent about bad quality and all of that kind of thing. But I think we need to appropriate the function to the correct place. A school, I'm talking about a school for children, can't operate without the consent of the Director General or the Superintendent General of Education in a province. Now, that is clearly located as a provincial function. Now, if the portfolio committee and if the minister would like SACWA to take a proactive stance in it, the means to do that is to give SACWA a directive, and SACWA will do it. But if SACWA were to unilaterally take this matter and go forward, I can tell you the political fallout that we will have. We'll be told by the provincial departments of why we're interfering in their business, all of that kind of thing. And given the fact that SACWA operates on a 60 million rand budget, of which 37 comes from the state. So you have to look at, if you want to have a unit, to just go and look at all these schools that are operating illegally. It's a different ballgame. So we're quite happy to go out on a campaign, but then we need the mandate.
Members, I want to suggest that we will be wrapping up this part. But I have to say that, and I think I want to thank the chairperson, the CEO, and the deputy for your input. And it was on the issues that were requested. I'm also glad for the contextualization in the beginning. Listening to the input and the questions from our members, for me it's very clear that the opportunity of a more integrated education system at higher education and training level will have to appreciate the moment much more, because the reality is that FETs are now moving to national, the universities, the skills funds, and a range of those things, and therefore the integration model will have to be appreciated stronger. 15, 16 years after the advent of a democracy, just hearing that we don't have a proactive strategy to deal with service providers, member Gubai, I think it's a shame on us, and broadly a shame on the system here. The fact that we are in, with all the type of advances that we've got in systems, and we've got in, I think in government speak, there are systems, we can go to different departments. The fact that we are not speaking together on this, I was waiting for the actual, the number, how many providers or how many illegal colleges it is. It's 10, it's 20, it's 50. But it's not our responsibility in this province, in the Gauteng or the Western Cape or in Mpumalanga, that's where it's the worst. I'm interested in that type of detail, because unless we've got that detail, we are not able to, as a parliament, activate our responsibility as an activist parliament, as the president has said. I think gone are the days for our committees to just look at regulatory discussions. But we in fact do want to hold the executive much more comfortable. So for one, the issue about the career guidance advisory centre and service, and the chairperson has raised it consistently on the helpline. I think we need a discussion on that in particular. But we therefore don't need only SACWA. We need the relevant structures that you in a sense are starting to work with, one. Secondly, I remember when visiting England, Mr. Isaacs, the issue about the opportunity around these two models in the world, and this lady, is it Trish, that indicated the New Zealand model is a much more closer model to the South African scenario. I possibly think it's important to either brief our committee on what's happening in that space, and not myself, but I think even some of our committee members to possibly play a much more closer role in that, and even most probably be invited on that visit. The second one is the RPL. There was no questions necessarily on that subject when you made the address on it, but in the beginning there were. The issue of the unfunded mandate we must immediately deal with, and I in a sense feel that we must make a statement, member, goodbye, myself or yourself, in the House on that matter. Whether it's unfunded mandate or whether it's not, but that issue, you can't have a policy perspective on RPL, and then you do not have the necessary means to support that. Especially the minister has raised, and I think we've got a minister that takes the debate right into the sense of the public, and some like it and some doesn't like it, but the importance is that there's a debate. He raised in his budget speech the fact of people having to, if you're 40 years old or 35, etc., and you've gone through all of those experiences and not able to access the university, but you most probably would be able to get into. What you are saying is that the RPL model, in the little way as you've, on an ad hoc basis, practicalized it, and it seems to me it's not SACWA, but in this case it's much more the university, that there's something that we can learn from. So if we can agree that we pull in Parliament the issue about the RPL more stronger, one, and two, if you can provide us a two-pager on what would you believe is parliamentary, what is the regulatory gaps, as you've talked about regulation, or the legislative gaps to strengthen the RPL model, I think it would be important to get that. I would have a wish that in a year from now that we would all, as our members around the table, have gone through our development portfolio development or whatever, yeah. Because I think one of our personal commitments that this committee made, if we are higher education and training, how do we do self-development also? meaning we can, so as we speak on all these bigger issues, because I think we've agreed that we are not all experts at a particular level, and we come from our own historical perspectives and our baggages of yesteryear, and we are all pulling it into one, and now we must give direction, nogal at a very high level, on high education and training. And as we are giving direction at that very high level, we need to be capacitated, etc. So there would be an interest, surely, for us to even from a subjective level, not necessarily our committee, but I think Parliament itself, that we would want to take that issue of RPLing forward. The National Learner Record Database, I think we've talked to those issues. So if I can have that two-page, say at least 7 days from now, it will help all of us. On the regulatory framework and the requirements and all of that, I think the issue that the members raised and Member Kubai has articulated it, I think, give us more detail. We now know that it's not necessarily your responsibility, but the implications are on you. Give us a little bit more information on that. So when you were responsible CEO, how many did you deregister? Who are they? Have they registered again? Did they just move to another system and they're in the system again? Those that are not qualified to actually be providers, are they not getting actual funding from the state as we're speaking now? So on the one side we say they are not supposed, but on another side we're actually funding them. And that lack of synergy then becomes relevant. So if we also can have a page or two just on that issue, give a bit more detailed perspective. I believe that in the future the committee then will zoom in on that in particular. And we'll take it up with the department specifically. Also, and our member of the ministry is always present, so she quietly sits there at the back and are able to take back some of that information as it came out. But I do think that I'll most probably schedule a meeting with the minister after we receive some of that. I am concerned about lack of integration of information. Serious concern. With that, members, let's thank the presenters. Also, thank you for the documentation and the books that we've received. I've been informed that this one is barely fresh from the press. Literally last week came out. So thanks a lot, and we hope to have a close interaction with this also in the future. Emma, shall we break for 5 minutes and then come back and let's see coffee business of that?
This number is just regularly available.
I don't
know. No, the telephone. But if you lose the documentation.
Yeah. Yes. That's exactly that. Yeah. All my books are written my number.
Is it? Oh, okay. All everything.
My book?
I think I need this documentation.
Oh, yeah.
But will you go to the person which was responsible and actually sit down and say he's not happy? I mean, if that was the case. No, you don't. Because we, when you put up on the you got that?
I got the end.
Okay, but then you saw, and then you saw that the difference.
I mean, it's fun to take a look at the
You know, I refresh some figures.
Is it late yesterday?
Yeah.
Okay.
The next few minutes have to do with the minutes, the draft report, because the deadline is the 28th, so we'll be submitting it, and we just wanted to make sure. But let's start with the minutes of the 11th of August. Everyone's got that?
Mm-hmm.
Ashwana? Okay. Now, just in the introduction, meeting proceedings, you'd remember, and I think it must be notified in that way, that I actually came, that the chairperson for the beginning of that meeting was Member Nahetro. So you might just put it in so that it's clear that that was in the beginning. Then, I think under 2A, undergraduate enrollments have growing by 4.9. It's just a little bit of, it's have been. Page 2, sorry. Yeah. I think we're on the same one, eh? You've got it? And then there's page 4. If you can remember, I just want to verify that on the first paragraph or the second paragraph on page 4, the issue of blacklisting non-paying students emerged as one of the factors that contributed to the unemployment graduates. Is it as is? Or is it negatively contributed? Can you see that sentence?
Yeah.
I'm trying to because we got the minutes, so we're just looking at the correctness of it. Yeah, Khadeva, it's page 4, that sentence, the issue of blacklisting non-paying students emerged as one of the factors that contributed to the unemployment graduates. That's what I'm saying. Now, I was not in that debate in the beginning, so I just want clarity. What was the point that you, Anela, what was the issue there? Can you remember the debate there?
It was raised as one of the factors that jeopardized.
So it's a negative factor.
Exactly, yeah.
Contributing negatively to the unemployment of graduates. Is that what? You've got it? Because you comfortable?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And then...
No. There's something wrong. You can't say contributed negatively to unemployment. Right?
To the...
To employment. It can't, you can't... negatively
to
employment.
Could you just tell me what you just said? That contributed to the unemployment of graduates.
So you just add of and leave everything as is. Huh? You've got it?
Yes.
Okay. Then, and is that page 4 at the bottom? However, a shocking revelation was that most of the country's first-year students, is that true? Was that said?
Where are you now?
Bottom page 4.
Yeah, okay.
You understand what I'm saying? It is not factually true. It can't be.
Can say an alarming number,
but
you can't say most.
It's definitely not most.
And most can be anywhere between
51% to 99%. Yeah, you understand what we get into. So it's not most of, it's, you can say a critical mass or critical number. What do you want? An alarming number of the country's first year. Okay? An alarming number, yeah.
Can I just get clarity, Chairman, on the report itself? Is it that the report seeks to highlight issues discussed, or is it intended to tell what happened during the... Because I remember that during blacklisting, it was raised by the members,
as an issue that was jeopardizing the future of the graduates, etc., etc. However, the NS staff assured us that as soon as students were employed, they were greenlisted. And they're saying, are we just identifying issues without having to say, therefore, here was the response? I'm asking. Because if you just leave it at that, you
as if there was not a, yeah.
As though there was no, we were assured. In fact, because you raised it as a huge issue, we were assured that as soon as the, then they were lifted off the
Okay, just hang on. Let me, on this particular issue, let just note then, Member Shwana, Dr. James, and Member Kumar.
Thank you. I want to make a follow up on what was said by my colleague over there. It still remained a problem, if I remember, a challenge even in that meeting. If they assured that once you are employed, then you will be deregistered, you will be taken off the list. The question was, you usually were not able to get an employment, so that it would never happen to you, because who are going to employ you if you are like blacklisted? So that it's not a solution in itself. We were like saying if they can do away with it, if I remember correctly, such that it's cruelty to these students, why blacklist them? Because they were given money to go to school, and if you don't end up working, you end up blacklisted. I think that's what we talked about.
It remained a debate even after the response, and I think Member Khadeva, even in this last meeting, you've raised that again. I think it was when DBSA presented. Can we settle with that, Dr. James?
Just in terms of the status of this document, it's a record of the proceedings. Mm. So let me just capture the record accurately.
The discussions, etc.
That's the only point I wanted to make.
Can we rest with that, Member? Yeah,
I just said that it helps in terms of how we capture the recording, because it assists us to say this is what happened in the meeting.
Mm.
But when we do a follow-up, we know this is what either NSFAS has committed to, and this is what we have requested. So that's why I was making that point on that one. Thanks.
Okay, page 5.
Sorry. The following sentence after the alarming number of the country students, where we have removed most, it continues to say, it's the third, it's not the worst name. The second, it says, in most students dropping out, can't we then put it in line with the worst name, the sentence that we have corrected, we have removed most, and the alarming number again.
Are you comfortable?
Yes, I think we may be comfortable, but I thought this part has to be consistent with where we got this information. So you don't just, because this one must be almost quoted, why do we get the sources? If the source was as per some study that was done to saying those new entrants at universities are not able to read, write, and so on, comprehend issues, what are they saying themselves? Are they saying most? Are they saying alarming? So that we don't choose what we want to say. We base that on what they are saying. It may be that we ourselves have got views around that, but I thought it's as per presentation and we must be consistent. So it may be that the secretary may just have to double check that. Why do they get this most? Is it as per the report? It's alleged that most are like this. So we just caught things as they are. Yeah.
On that point, there were two sources.
Member McAvilla, just be on mic.
There are two sources of information around this. The first is the National Benchmark Study that was done at the University of Cape Town. It was published in the Cape Times, right? And then it was Tiens Eloff who told us that in the meeting. And this record here is of Tiens Eloff's. So it was part of the briefing of CHE, is it? Represented by Tiens Eloff. He's the one who said it was most.
That's what I was asking. Did the person, because remember when he presented, some of us were not there.
Yes.
Did he say, all that I want to know, did he say it was most of?
Then we should leave it like that.
Then if he says it, if it was said in that way, that's why I was asking, was it factually what was said in the meeting?
Chair, he didn't say most of, he gave numbers. he actually presented figures.
Yeah. I think we are advising the secretary, it's a very simple thing actually. If he have said, and that's where our member there is correct, if it was said by Yisa, most of the students, we'll have to say that, right? We can put it and we can qualify by saying that's what the presenter said. If he did not say that, then it would be a problem in the way it is reflected there.
This is my last word in the chair.
I recall that he didn't say most of. He actually presented numbers. Because it makes a huge difference if it's 99% or 51%. That's also most of. But I think he presented numbers. I remember him saying 62% or 55%. So if he did that, it should be reflected in the actual numbers. Otherwise, alarming.
Yeah.
Maybe because it seems like for those of us who are not there, there's like, for those who are there, there's not an agreement. And I think the only thing that is going to assist us is to get the actual, for Anel to verify what was recorded in the discussion. Otherwise, we're going to have this discussion first, and that would assist.
Agreed. And the reason for that is, it's just, look, this becomes a document that we agree on. And if this document says most of, and actually it is not factual that it is most of, it does become a problem. Because you can do a lot of things out of this document.
Chairperson, I think you are covering what I wanted to say, but I remember there was black about it. I remember. It was like black students who were not completing, and we debated about that, if you recall with me. Maybe the issue that must be deep. Yeah, definitely. But I think...
Yeah.
But could I... Am I still protected to complete this sentence? Or is it because I'm from mining? There is possibly... Yeah, the last sentence... Dropping out in their first year and possibly never, maybe it's probably never coming back.
Thank you.
Can I make a ruling on that? That paragraph, we are requesting Anela just to go back and just to verify. It's literally the issue about, is it technically what was said by the individual? If that was said, I in a sense would want to suggest you say, and yes, sir, in the input said the following. You'll do that. So we qualify that it's not us, because it can easily read that the committee. That's one. Secondly, if it did not say it, then we go with what was that word that you've brought in, Dr. James? No, we made a suggestion. Alarming, yeah. If it was not said as most of, we just introduced the word alarming. Can we?
Just to appeal to Anel, especially on this minute, can you make sure that it's 100% what is said in the discussion? Prof. Staines has come out to say he was quoted out of context in that discussion. I don't know if you are aware. So the reflection of that true discussion is important, because somehow when we have a follow-up, we'd like to utilize that. So actually, if you can just verify that all the discussion, specifically on this minute, especially if somebody comes to a committee and then later comes to media and says, I was quoted out of context.
So the media quoted him out of context or something?
No, I think the discussion and the media quoted him out of context.
Yeah.
And even the way the discussion was going, it's not what. Mm. So I think we would have to be vigilant, especially on this minute.
Mm. Okay, page 5. First paragraph, page 5. Second line there, to trace all the students who have dropped out in the public higher education institutions over recent years, isn't it? a resolution. Anything there that you've picked up? Okay, but what I, the reason why I've gone through it in the way I've gone through it, there's basic mistakes. So in a sense, just the quality of before it gets to the members. So Anela and Dennis possibly, just the moment that, before it gets out. So when I got it yesterday, I said, it's fine, get it out because we got it yesterday, and I started to look into this. So if we can just scan it again before it goes out in terms of the quality of the minutes, that's one. I think there is a different discussion around what you really put in and what you don't put in. At times, for example, it's not to record all the discussions, but it's to record all the critical issues that came out of the discussion.